Blog Talk Radio.
We just heard from the Concerto of Silence, where the whole entire band was playing their instruments in complete silence. That was the von Flossenfurken concerto in E flat silencio. Very good music there, ladies and gentlemen. And next we're going to hear from one of the most popular silent songs of all time, from Lomelars Norfners, Deep, Deep Silencio. And in this, he has over 400 band members, 400 instruments on stage, in complete silence. And they play for over 2 hours. It is one of the greatest moments. You sit there and you watch, and they just play their instruments without actually touching the strings or blowing on the horns. It's amazing to hear the silence that comes from it. It is so loud when they play their silence. Flirtlarm de Fleur is an amazing concerto silencio artist. I saw him one time in Paris, where he played for, again, 2 hours. I think it was over 2 hours, I'm pretty sure. 2 hours, amazed the crowd at how silent he could be, and how silent that entire band was for the whole time. It was amazing. And I mean amazing. So we are about to hear from him, and it's going to be really incredible. I cannot wait at all.
Wait a minute. Wrong show. That's right. We're not listening to silence. We probably will want to after this show, though. Sorry about the silence. More technical difficulties, ladies and gentlemen. Return of the Dead.
Crazy, mad, insane world. Weevils wobble, but they don't fall down. Pass it on.
This space is for rent. How much are you willing to pay?
Cool, Mr. Oliver Goat Cheese.
Like everybody's just trying to give you grief.
damn what anybody thinks of what I've done. That's life. I've been a puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn and a king. I've been up and down and over and out, and I know one thing. Each time I find myself flat on my face, I pick myself up and get back in the race. That's life.
It's a crazy, mad, insane world.
Easy to bitch, easy to whine, easy to moan, easy to cry, easy to feel like there ain't nothing in your life. Harder to work, harder to strive, harder to be glad to be alive. But it's really worth it if you give it a try. Easy to bitch, easy to whine, easy to moan, easy to cry, harder to work, harder to strive, harder to be glad to be alive.
It takes one to know one.
Jack rules.
Here is your host, Jack Hatfield.
But we are here. We are here. We're live and we're back and we're so sorry. We took so much time off, but we had lots of things to do. Lots of things that come up and bit us in the tail and said, guess what? You are going to pay attention. One of those, I would be remiss if I did not have to say that my mom's birthday was this month. So there was a slight pause for celebrating that, that did not need to be done on the air. And then we moved on, and we did our celebration. We had a great time, and did what we would have done had she been with us. I can promise you that. So. We're back. We're here. We've got some exciting guests coming up for you in the future. We've got all kinds of new stuff happening. We have, this is just exciting, how this show is growing leaps and bounds because of you, the listeners, because you guys and gals and beautiful people. I know each and every one of you have a face for radio just like I do. And no, I'm kidding. You're all beautiful. I'm the one with the face for radio. And I really, really just appreciate each and every one of you listening out, following me, keeping my tweets, listening to me, giving me feedback on all the things we're doing. And like I said, third book in the works. Going to be great. Can't wait. Lots of things are going to be fun. It's going to be a big, big ride. But all of that can wait a minute. Let's get to it and get started at the show, people. Come on. First story is going to blow your mind. A little relaxing. All right, here we go. So there was a trial in Portland for Kemonta Peterson. That's right. Kemonta Peterson was in Portland, Oregon. She avoided jail. Now, lots of criminals take plea bargains, ladies and gentlemen. lots of criminals take plea bargains. So she plead herself down to a first degree criminal mistreatment. And so she avoided jail time. How about that? Pretty good, huh? Pretty good. Good to go for Kimonta. I hope I'm saying that right. Kimonta Peterson. But let's dig a little deeper into what Peterson did. What happened was she called 911 and her son was rushed to a hospital last October. That's right. She was really, really, really trying to save her son, right? Maybe. No, not really. Here's what happened. Her 13-year-old son wouldn't stop bleeding. After she attempted to do her own home circumcision, she used a box cutter and pliers. Oh, excuse me, I am so sorry. The circumcision was on a 3-month-old. The 13-year-old son was helping. Wow. So she grabbed some pliers, grabbed that box cutter, and followed tips and tricks from your favorite video website, YouTube. That's right. She watched the do-it-yourself home circumcision video series that, you know, you can purchase that on DVD, but of course it's also free on YouTube. So she hit there, subscribed to the home circumcision channel, proceeded to watch a series of YouTube videos that showed her exactly the best way to do this. And apparently it's as hard to laugh at this because it's so tragic, but it's also, wow. Apparently in the video, I guess they used pliers and box cutters, unless she didn't have the scalpel and the whole, surgical room and stuff. And maybe it was a circumcision in a hospital. And she went to her, you know, her kitchen drawer looking for the scalpel and the forceps and the clamps and the whole surgical team. But of course, they don't fit in a drawer. So she found that box cutter and a pair of pliers and proceeded to just go on about her surgery here at home with her. Now, she's 30 years old, ladies and gentlemen. She's 30 years old. All right, and here's the other problem. She took 2 hours before she called 911. The infant was bleeding uncontrollably and in intense pain. She began the operation. This is even just more hilarious. She went to bed and then woke up at midnight to begin this surgical procedure. Apparently, she found out midnight was the proper time to wake an infant up and start your home circumcision process. When the bleeding would not stop, she tried to stitch up the wound while her 13-year-old son watched. And after 2 hours of uncontrolled bleeding, she finally called the paramedics. The reason she did so, two reasons actually. She was inspired to carry it out after reading the Bible that evening, and the hospitals in Portland do not carry out the operation on boys older than 4 weeks. So, there you go. By the way, there are two other children in her house that had to deal with this home circumcision. But again, she's not going to jail. Her lawyers have said that she was hallucinating, prevented her from sleeping for days, and, you know, she's crazy all of a sudden. This is her fourth child, ladies and gentlemen. She did not do it to the other children, but all of a sudden, she went crazy. That's exactly what you think of. After watching YouTube videos, I really do hope, I haven't searched YouTube, but I haven't done any research on this, but really do hope. I'm just saying. Here's another fabulous story. As you know, I love starting off with stories that make you go, what's going on with people? What is going on with people? As most of my listeners remember, this show used to be called Fix the Family, Fix America. And while we still do that, we had to pull back one because we found there are more and more people with problems. We can't even get to the family yet. Now, that family of five just got really blown up pretty bad. Can you imagine the 13-year-old's mindset right now after mom pliers and box cutters his brother? Can you imagine what he's in his 13-year-old mind, what he's going through right now? Mom grabbed him with pliers, cut him with a box cutter, and then for 2 hours he bled, and then the paramedics came, and now mom's in jail. Or in a crazy place. Wow, that's going to take some talking to. Well, just a 1 year older, a 14-year-old boy, let's talk about that. Now, he was playing video games. Now, let me tell you, you know, there are some incredible games out there, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know about you, but I'm into some of the games. I do like them. Duke Nukem, one of the games I've been playing since Text. Was a game where you actually went left and it went wall and you went right and it went wall. You went right door, open door. You had to type it and it went, you went through door and see a wall. That we actually played that for hours on end. Hours. Anyway, back to our story. The 14-year-old is in custody. He was playing a video game, which, of course, like I said, is probably playing a really, really cool video. And then his grandma come in, right? And said, I'm going to need you to stop playing that video game. Because we got to eat dinner or something. I don't know the reason. But she said no. Well, he went and grabbed a sword. That's right, a sword. And he took the sword not to his grandmother. Grandmother was a little fast because she's only 50. But great-grandma, 77, a little slower, got stabbed with a sword. Now, the grandmother, the 50-year-old, was wounded in the arm. But what they're saying was he was just very angry. He grabbed the sword and he started going off on Grammy and great-grammy. Not only was he so upset about stopping this game, I want you to grasp the mindset of these teens, ladies and gentlemen. When the cops came, they had to taser the 14-year-old boy because he kept them in a standoff with a pellet gun. He shot at cops with a pellet gun. Here's more fascinating facts from this wonderful teenage boy. This was the third time in 3 months the teen had been arrested. authorities already had one sword that they confiscated from him in an earlier arrest. Who said, you know what? He's just a kid. Give him back to Grammy. Just take his sword. He'll be fine. When the cops got there, Grammy was barricaded inside a room. Great grandma was lying dead on the ground outside the home. He was standing in a doorway with a full-size sword and a pellet rifle. He started shot two windows out of a patrol car, shooting at us with the pellet gun and swinging the sword around in the air. Give credit to the cops now. They did not shoot back. They could have just, of course, blown away the 14-year-old. Pellet gun, really? Here's real bullets. Here's what they feel like. But they didn't. They distracted him with an explosive device. It got his attention. Then canine went, and he hit the canine dog with the butt of the pellet gun. Then we tased him and took him down. Douglas County Sheriff Phil Miller was very happy and pleased that they did not shoot at the boy. What's even more amazing is I personally know Phil Miller. A neighbor who lives across the street said the boy would wave at her whenever she came home, just all happy. No big deal. Now, cops, Phil Miller, which I personally know, which is amazing after seeing his picture, said that the sword that killed Great Grammy was not the sword they have in custody. He obviously got a hold of another sword. And he has been a danger to himself, a danger to his family, and a danger to the community. He's a little kid with glasses and kind of shy. But that shyness was totally abdicated when Graham said, stop playing the video game. That is not good at all. I bring up stories like this because I want you to grasp what's going on in the world today. And we are going to talk about some deep, deep stuff in the second hour. Deep. There's not a lot of stories like this from 50 years ago, or 60 years ago, or even 40 years ago. We've highlighted stories like this a lot on this show. What about the boy who killed his parents and then threw a party? Killed his parents, locked him in the bedroom, threw a party, because they told him he couldn't have that party. Where is the mentality coming from in today's teenagers and children that when a parent or a guardian or any, figurehead in their life says no or can't or stop, the child thinks and feels that it is still his right to do what he feels that he can do, even though he is not of the government's legal age? Where is the rearing of the child errors happening? For these children to think, you can't tell me what to do, I'll just kill you. I'll just kill you. We're going to start studying this on a little bit on every part of this show. We're going to have a little insight into the world of what's happening. let's even go a little further, shall we? Let's take this thought somewhere where probably I can hear producers cringing. The riots in London. Lots of children and teenagers running around for fun. Because they feel that they deserve what they are looting and stealing. Where in their mindset is it that they are held back? Where in their mindset is it that they cannot ever succeed, so they feel that they must, this is how they're going to take it? Where in the mindset of this 14-year-old boy, when Graham says, don't play any more video games, he says, it's my life. Did you buy the game? Did you buy the stuff? Did you buy the TV? Are you paying on the house? Are you buying the electricity? None of that is probably true, so guess what? Sorry, but that's the way life is when you grow up. A figurehead says no, and that is no. When did that stop? When did respect for police, parents, Grammys, all go away? When did respect for just morals of taking something? And not just taking something because you need it, taking something because you had nothing else to do that day. There was interviews of the rioters in London that did it for fun. They said, well, somebody texted, tweeted me, and said, come on down and pick up a thing. I got some free booze in this liquor store. And they said, we had nothing else to do, so we came down and got a bottle. TV reporters actually interviewed people in the morning, no, in the afternoon. They've been drinking from the bottle all day. I'm sorry, but I remember that one phrase in the interview. She says bottle very that way. I'm not going to take up the entire first hour of this segment of this show talking about teens and their issues, but we are going to have a look into this deeper and deeper as we go into the shows of September. Since school is back, what can we do in the school system to fix this? What can we do in the parental system to fix this? What can we do in children's heads to fix this? We'll have a guest coming up real soon that's going to have some who started a whole new deal of trying to help people. We're gonna talk to him soon. Working on the schedule for that right now. Can't tell you everything until it gets nailed down. But people are seeing the problems and people are coming to fix it. And that's what we do here. It's all very tied together. The morality of teenagers are gone. We've got to find a way to solve it. And we're going to look into it deep here on this show, the Jack Atfield Show. But I don't know if I can help. We have a segment like this almost every week, but I don't think I can help.
I got a crazy wife. I got a crazy wife. I got a crazy wife.
All right. Well, Lalaya, okay, went to work. I mean, got up, did her normal routine on a Tuesday. Did her normal routine, got dressed, went in the bathroom, did her thing, got dressed, went to work. Worked all at her office job. Came back home. Lalaya. It's an interesting name. Lalaya. Came back home. You know, she obviously felt something special. She cooked a candlelight dinner for two. for her husband, Kalpik. Could be Kalpik. And then something made her mad. Yep. Something got her a little upset. So she got totally out of control and took a kitchen knife during the meal and stabbed her husband just above the heart. He died in a few minutes from severe blood loss. Cops went, Lalaya, what happened? She said, well, he didn't remember my birthday. Today's my 45th birthday. And I went to work. I woke up, no birthday present. I went to work, came home expecting a bunch of flowers and a present. Nothing. I did a candlelight dinner for two throughout the entire meal. He just was oblivious to the big day. So I stabbed him. I'm saying it that way because this happened in Russia. That's just hilarious. So, men, in all over the world, I am especially to my Russian listeners right now, think hard. Because you're, 10 hours ahead of me right now? So you're waking up in a few minutes. And you've got to think hard. Is it your wife's birthday? Because this will set a precedent. Remember when Lorena Bobbitt did her thing, we had like 10 of those coming after that. So we don't need suddenly tomorrow the 1.2 million women birthdays in Russia suddenly come up with 100,000 dead husbands at dinner because they forgot. Not good. Not good.
I got a crazy wife. I got a crazy wife. I got a crazy wife.
Some people wrote me and said, you know, why don't you have a crazy husband segment? Well, that's easy because there's lots of crazy men out there. But plus, no one's ever written a song called I Have a Crazy Husband. So there. That's why we don't have a crazy husband. Plus, there's not as many crazy wife stories. That's not true. It's probably just the same. People are getting crazy. I don't even know what to do. Just today, a new survey comes out that shows over 13% of all human beings, that's right, when talking to another person, now I can see this. I really can see this. Actually, in the 18, 29-year-old age, it's 30%. Anyway, 13 to 30%. Admit to sitting there listening to someone and then pretending that they got a fake phone call on their mobile phone to stop speaking to that person or to avoid speaking to that person. Oh, my. Be talking to someone going, sorry, I got to take this. Gotta take this. Better than you is what I'm trying to say. Better than you. Can you imagine you put the phone in your ear and it really rings? And be like, oops, well, I knew it was going to happen. Then you have to tell him, I knew I was getting a call. I was just didn't want anybody to know I had ESPN. Oh, well. Oh. Oh. Whew. For a small second, let's collect our thoughts. The Jack Hatfield Show. Follow me on Twitter. Twitter.com/JackHatfield. Doctor right now, his glasses hanging halfway off his nose, looking at you going, on your holiday, are you really going to indulge a little? Anyway, this condition, this disease is called holiday heart syndrome, and it can affect healthy people of any age, although it appears to be more common in middle age. That's right, because those teenagers that go down and drink till they can't see, they're not going to have. But you middle agers who's worked for the past 20 years and finally get that one vacation, when you have that third glass of wine, you are going to die. That's right. Goodness. Now, as you probably can guess, this study leads into something else. And guess what that is? Oh, yeah, the study is, it's not only when you go on a holiday and drink, it's now even when you do it on the weekend. What they're saying is more and more people are abstaining from alcohol during the week and binge drinking on Friday and Saturday night. That tells me that you need more practice. That's what they're saying. They're saying that more and more people are abstaining from alcohol because what have they done with alcohol? They sit there and tell you it's absolutely the worst thing you could possibly do in your body other than smoking, right? Or being fat. Those are the big three, are they not? Smoking, obesity, not eating broccoli, and drinking. The worst. But now, if you do what they say, and then on Friday and Saturday you kind of let loose, or, God forbid, you go on a vacation, and you have that third glass of wine, you could have holiday heart syndrome. In medical terms, let me tell you what this means to them. For a woman, this is two large glasses of wine. For a man, it's 3 pints of strong lager. It has now reached middle class epidemic. Bum, bum, bum. A typical holiday heart scenario. Wait a minute. I got to get the right while I put this on. Here's a good one. Thanks, producer. All right, here we go. Typical holiday heart scenario. This would be something that I'm going through. The dreaded abnormal heart rhythm.
That's right.
With the alcohol coursing through their bodies, you may start to experience palpitations, breathlessness, and sometimes lightheadedness, and chest pain. You may be having fun and dancing. Oh, wait. Dr. Klang says, the symptoms are very unpleasant. This is his big description here. This is consultant cardiologist Jonathan Clegg. Okay? These symptoms are very unpleasant. Okay. So now you know, like, when you go out on Friday night to get your groove on and you have palpitations or breathlessness and sometimes lightheadedness and or chest pains, it's not the greasy taco that you just ate from the bar or the street vendor. It's because you had those 2 glasses of large glasses of wine in a single session. Dr. Clay goes on, everyone reacts differently to an abnormal heart rhythm, but your heart rate may feel like it's racing and you may feel lightheaded and start to sweat. Many feel like they're having a heart attack or about to die. These symptoms are very unpleasant. Brr. Brr. Oh, here's the good news. Although the symptoms will usually disappear without medical treatment within 24 to 48 hours, meaning you get over it, you drink some more, you get drunk, have a good time, go to bed, wake up, you're good to go. But here's the bad news. They're likely to return if you do another subsequent binge. Dun, dun, dun. That's right. If you go do it again, you could possibly experience it again. This is weird. I'm glad we had this study. Goodness. The leading hypothesis, ladies and gentlemen, California-based cardiologist Dr. Arthur Klasky says the leading hypothesis, meaning we don't know, but the best guess we got is adrenaline is released when a person drinks a lot of alcohol. That's right. They kind of feel fearless. Right? Now, cases tend to peak over holiday periods, such as summer holidays or Christmas. Goodness. Most people don't know that alcohol damages the heart muscle. Now, here's another amazing fact about this holiday heart syndrome. The most common patient that is going to feel this and possibly die from it is the person that is aged 40 to 55 who is still exercising hard, particularly running. That's right. The person that's going to experience holiday heart syndrome the most is age 40 to 55 who is exercising very hard, like running. Dr. Clegg says it's not clear how exercise plays a part, but it's possible that strenuous exercise stretches the left atrium, which receives and pumps blood into the heart. And when this is combined with alcohol, you will get an attack of the palpitations. So, are they saying stop exercising? If you get 40, don't exercise so hard? Or maybe just we're all doing the wrong stuff. Maybe there's a deeper look into why suddenly heart rhythms can be broken by a beverage. Possibly a deeper look. But now you know. So when you go on your vacation or on the weekend, you start to feel heart palpitations, be careful. Be careful out there. It's what we try to do here on the Jack Hatfield Show. But before we go any further with our exciting news of the day, which I'm running out of time, goodness, that's because we were met with silence at the beginning of this thing. Here's something that a lot of people say. Well, stop drinking alcohol and drink freshly squeezed orange juice. There's so many 100% juices on the market today. It's very easy to go and find one and make it happen, right? Have you ever wondered when the bottle says 100% juice and not from concentrate? Have you ever wondered why it always tastes the same? Here's something horrible, people, for all you orange juice drinkers out there and for all the people that love that whole new stuff that says they're simply made from oranges. Here's the key. After the oranges are squeezed, the juice is stored in giant holding tanks and the oxygen is removed from them, which allows the orange juice to keep for up to a year without spoiling. Okay. That's right. They boil it and remove the oxygen. Because what kills food? Oxidation. Right? Right. Have you also noticed that every brand that says they're 100% orange juice, no problem, all have their own signature flavor? That's because they pay. That's right. They pay the same people who work on Dior perfumes for Dior and Calvin Klein. That's right. To create a flavor pack. So when the juice is stripped from oxygen, it is also stripped of the flavor-providing chemicals, so it's tasteless. It's a process known as deaeration. All right, so those flavor packs, which don't have to be mentioned on the label, are added back to the juice to make it taste fresh. That's right. The orange juice is actually sitting in a million-gallon tank for upwards of a year and then put into the bottle with a flavor pack to make it taste fresh. Does that sound good for you? Those in the industry will tell you that these flavor packs, whether made from reconstituted or pasteurized orange juice, resemble nothing found in nature. The juice is typically designed to appeal to the taste preference of the market. All right? The juice created for the North American market tends to contain high amounts of ethyl butyrate, which is one of the most commonly used chemicals in both flavors and fragrances. Aside from being versatile in creating a number of different flavors, including orange, cherry, pineapple, mango, guava, and bubblegum, just to name a few, is also one of the least expensive. If you have orange juice sold in Mexico or Brazil, there's different chemicals in decanols or terpene compounds because they like a different flavor. I don't know about you, but shouldn't someone have said this many years ago? That's right. The process of image in your mind of you having the farmer having the orange grove, going out and grabbing the oranges, squeezing them, putting it in a bottle, and giving it to you. Isn't that the picture you have? But no, it's nothing like that. The big truck goes by, picks the oranges, throws them in the truck. All the oranges are sitting through this big machine, squeezes the life out of the oranges. Well, squeezes the good stuff out of the oranges. Right then, it's fantastic. They put them in these big old million-gallon tanks, and they de-aerate the juice, the oxygen, the life-giving oxygen that was in the juice is removed. And then it's boiled to remove anything else. And then so you don't know about anything they just did, they re-flavor it. And you get on the shelf in a pretty bottle, label says 100% fresh squeezed orange juice, not from concentrate. Here's the other problem. That you should guess this. Those bottles can sit 60, 90 days on the shelf. You go get oranges and squeeze them in a bottle at your house and see how long that juice lasts. Only a few days. Because it's real. That's a sad, sad scenario, ladies and gentlemen. Sad, sad scenario. I had to bring that up. Totally disgusted. Amazing. Just amazing. Speaking of vodka and orange juice, I mean, screwdrivers. All of you men out there thinking about stopping after the show's over, hit the club. So hit that club and you're gonna go and you're gonna drop some GHB to the girls. Thank you. caught up with them. That's right. A simple stir of your drink could soon reveal whether it's been spiked with date rape drugs. Scientists have now developed a straw-shaped sensor that detects these two drugs, ketamine and GHB. If the drugs are present, the straw lights up, a tiny red light warning those even in dark bars to ditch their drink. Making the sensor fast and accurate and affordable is the greatest challenge. These things are happening at a rapid rate. They've actually come up with a card, credit card, that you can purchase. Put a little piece of spit or blood in it, and you can have an HIV test right there that has been shown 90-something percent accurate. And it's able to sell for pennies. Can you imagine now in bars, you've got a straw that if someone comes up to the bartender and goes, look, I need to check my drink. I wasn't able to watch it for a few minutes to see if someone dropped something in it. And he sticks the straw in and, you know, red light comes on, new drink. And then you go punch out the dude who did it. Or you don't have any date rape drugs in your drink. You just find the person attractive. So you'd like to say hello. Well, go to the machine, credit card, pull it out, pick your finger, both of you check it, HIV free, let's roll. These things are happening on a commonality basis. These things are going to be there. It's going to be amazing part of everyone's life. Here's the cool thing. This new straw can be used over and over and over and over until it gets positive. That's right. So a bar could have 100 that they then could clean if the date rape drug was not in it and just put it back and do it again. It can be used over and over and over until the positive, then it's useless. Wow. Couple that with the HIV credit card and soon bars will be safe all over. And that's not all science has been working on. Now they've got the AirCheck Wi-Fi tester by Fluke Networks. Law enforcement is using that to identify whether a network is open and secure to find child pornographers. It's a one-button handheld device that when they go to the child pornographer's home, they aim the antenna and they find that Wi-Fi signal that the child pornographer is using. And they know exactly the person where that they're targeting is and the suspect they were looking for. How about that? And now it's not just sex offenders. It can be fight phishing scammers, identity thieves, and internet stalkers. Because it can home in on the location of the suspect using the Wi-Fi. That's right, pretty soon that same device will be able to hone in on a cell phone conversation. We'll be able to come in, ride down the street of a neighborhood and find out what's happening on everyone's bandwidth in their wireless home. The brilliant law of attraction specialist. Anyway, she's one of the greatest. She's actually over across the pond in England. She's from Ireland. But she is just a fantastic lady. And here's where this show finally gets a little class. Adele Amani's magnificent.
Welcome to Adele's Magic Minutes. Each week I will be bringing you messages with help and advice around becoming a conscious creator. And I also will be here to answer your questions on any area in your life that you find that you have resistance at the moment. So please post your questions through to the Jack Hatfield Show, and I will answer them in the following week. Your dreams are the pulse of life. When you allow your dreams to fade, so does your pulse. When you allow your dreams to be unleashed, then you live. Trust in your heart, your passion. This is your direct connection to energy. This is what makes you abundant. And I know a lot of people have told you to think positive, to have the right thoughts, but why? In this show, I hope to go through some of the reasons that biologically, cellularly, this is so important. And I know that a lot of people have the idea that it's your thoughts that create the manifestation of your desires. This isn't altogether true. It's now been found and scientifically proven that your cells take their signal not from your environment, but from your beliefs. So this is not the same as your thoughts, because you can have random thoughts going through your head all day, as many people do. But the thoughts that you actually hold as your beliefs, these are ingrained. These are deep within you. And it is these that your cells take their signal from. They then transmit that through your body via your nervous system, which is in fact your electrical system. This then determines the frequency at which your body, cells and organs are going to resonate. In the energy frequency that you give out, you attract the same frequency back. So let me put this into everyday terms. Say you have a lack of self-belief. You would like to have a better job, or you would like more money coming in. And you're thinking about, yes, I've got a lot of money coming in. I know this job that I'll be really good at. And you keep thinking about it, but inside your belief is saying, it's never going to happen. I'm not good enough for that. I'm not going to be able to do that. All of my family have only ever worked in a particular area. That means I've got to do it too. And because you believe this, you are still resonating this out through your frequency. This is still what your energy is putting out there. Doesn't matter how many thoughts you have differently. Until you change that belief, then the energy and the frequency will not change. So your belief has to be in, I am wealthy, I am abundant. I can be, do and have everything I desire. A new job, I'm in that job already. I'm in there, I'm working with it, I'm doing really well, I'm being promoted. And I live and breathe this. This then becomes a belief, because you feel it, you taste it, you see it, you hear it. And once that becomes a belief, then your frequency begins to change. And for our frequencies to change, we have to move into higher frequency. The higher the frequency, the better our natural bodies are in health, and the more we allow to us, the more abundance comes to us. So it's not down to the thoughts, it's down to what you believe. And now it's time for you to really get that belief system going and working for you.
See? Didn't I tell you? More in Adele Amani's Magic Minute than most of my whole show. We're so glad to have have Adele and her teachings on the show. Guess what? Second hour.
Crazy, mad, insane world.
Weebles wobble, but they don't fall down. Pass it on.
This space is for rent. How much are you willing to pay?
Cool, Mr. Oliver Goatee.
Number one, every hour that you spend watching TV kills you for 22 minutes. That's right, removes 22 minutes off your life. Every hour removes 22 minutes. So 6 hours of TV a day will cut your life expectancy by 5 years. Woo! So now they're saying sedentary lifestyles is bad for health and as smoking and obesity. This is just another way to say move, basically, is what they're saying. But, of course, they have to attack something, so they're attacking the television, the telly. Remember, every cigarette cuts 11 minutes off your lifespan. They've said that for years. So you have to weigh the odds here. An hour of TV or a cigarette? No, two cigarettes. Wow, that doesn't seem fair. So if you smoke two cigarettes in an hour, it's the exact same risk as watching television. What they're saying, over in the UK, the average amount of time spent watching TV is 4 hours a day. In the United States, it's 5 hours a day. In Australia, it's 6 hours a day. What's going on? Really, 5 hours a day in America? Who does that?
We do it. I do it.
Some days, just to unwind, but not daily. Rather play a game. Type 2 diabetes and heart disease or dying prematurely rises by 20% after 2 hours a day in front of the box. So basically they're saying there is no time to watch television. You are immediately dying sitting there watching television. What about the secretary that sits at her desk? Works on her computer. Is that the same? What about a bus driver? Well, they're steering. They are moving their feet. The big key to this, ladies and gentlemen, is that exercise, physical activity, offers huge benefits. Sitting there getting to be 800 pounds is going to make your health suck. Now, another study, here we go, tied together, same amount of time. TV watching every hour takes away 22 minutes. Exercise for just 15 minutes a day adds 3 years of life. So, 6 hours a day on the TV cuts 5 years of your life off, but then if you can get up for 15 minutes, you knock that down to two. Are you seeing the math here? I'm trying to help you. Cancer deaths also fall by 1% for each additional 15 minutes of daily exercise after the first 15. But it reaches a peak at 100. So you can't just exercise all day and be cancer-free. I'm pretty sure you'll just drop dead. Your heart won't take it. As we see... Goodness gracious, don't be working your heart so much and then go drink. You'll get that holiday heart syndrome, the double HS. Not good. Not good. So the benefits of exercises were seen in both sexes across all age groups. They said 15 minutes a day is similar to benefits of quitting smoking. Wow, you see how they tie it together. Now, they're saying people who want to exercise but claim not to have much time can do exercise on the weekend once or twice a week. If they do vigorous intensity exercise. However, if you do it 2 days in a row, you increase the potential for injury and heart attacks. Use it or lose it. Now, you got two exact studies that are saying move. Okay? One study, TV, hour, knocks 22 minutes off your life. The other study, 15 minutes a day of exercising 3 years back. Now, I walked for 15 minutes a day. I used to walk for 15 minutes a day. And then by the end of the month, I was like 30 miles from home. So I didn't do that any longer. So the key is to move. Now, what we're going to talk about in this second hour, let's tie what we just learned about exercising in with your brain. I want to go through this top 10 habits of elite athletes. Okay? This is an article. Then we're going to find the truth. Remember? News, then the truth. Number 10, envision success. That's a very, very, very true fact. The only way to know that you can be successful is to visualize that success. If you are about to do something like make a putt or hit a ball, you've got to be able to see in your mind's eye exactly how that outcome is going to be before you do it. Because most athletes recognize a significant proportion of their performance is mental. Elite athletes frequently report visualizing their success before it happens. They play a mental movie of what's about to happen. It also calms their nerves, clears their visualization, and makes the impact more powerful. Here's number 9. Has nothing to do with number 10, but cool down. Number 8 has nothing to do with elite athletes. Consume sport drinks. No. You're working yourself to death. You do need optimal fuel and hydration. But it is not the reason that you are an elite athlete. That, number 8, was designed to sell more G. Number 7, very true here. Identify with successes. Nothing will cripple performance like damaged confidence. Every mistake holds a lesson, but dwelling on those mistakes would inevitably lead to their repetition. When athletes make mistakes, they try to learn from them and forget them instantly so they don't linger. Having a short memory and identifying with past successes help athletes maintain a high level of performance even after major setbacks. That is why even in life you don't remember the negatives. I've watched family members actually physically take their last breath. But it's not something you remember. You remember the good stuff. Number 6, post-game training. That doesn't make any sense either. Because one, if you're trying to learn a habit of an elite athlete, you're not playing a game. So basically, exercise. Number 5, nutrition. Yes. Pre-workout, lean protein, veggies and stuff. Post-workout, get some protein back in you. Number 4, quality sleep, very important. Athletes go to bed and wake up most of the time within an hour each day. During periods of increased training intensity of on, they sleep more, including naps. Here's 3 tough ones. No, two tough ones, and one for you. Follow an individualized training program. In other words, get a professionally designed training program with components of individualization. That's not something you and I normally get to go get. But we do get to do number two, set goals. Setting goals provides you with structure and constant motivation, which ensures continual progress. Number one, we don't get to do either unless we find a life coach, and that is work with coaches, because a variety of coaches invest in your success. Coaches are what makes everything else on this list possible. Strength coach works on your training program. Nutrition coach makes your nutrition program work. Sports coach can help athletes set performance and habit goals. A life coach can help you set goals and envision success. So you may not become the elite athlete, but you can be trained with a little help on being the best you could possibly be in all things about your life. Now, before I go into something deep in this last half hour, they are finding out that a baby's first 1,000 days before determines their health prospects for life. That's right, a growing body of research is pointing to the first 1,000 days of a child's life being of paramount importance. What happens during this, the 9 months in the womb and the first 2 years out of it, shape a child's chances of everything from developing diabetes to a heart attack. Life expectancy can be traced back to those early days and months, as can a lifelong battle of the bulge. Now, does this run tantamount with what I've already said about the sitting in front of the TV and exercising? Yes, slightly. They believe that if there are a number of critical stages in a child development, if conditions are not perfect at every stage, problems can occur down the line. Many of the danger points lie when the baby is still in the womb, when the brain, skeleton, immune systems are vulnerable up to the child's second birthday. Poor nutrition, smoking, stress, drugs, and alcohol can all take their toll. Now, I don't know how many babies are eating bad, smoking up some stuff, taking some stress drugs, and sucking down a martini. But apparently, it's happening a lot. Because it says right here, poor nutrition, smoking, stress, drugs, and alcohol can all take their toll. So in the first 1,000 years of life, we have to stop the babies from eating bad, getting their cool on, getting their martini on, and taking that Zoloft or whatever antidepressants are called. Yes, I'm kidding. I'm talking about the mother. Professor Barker, the guy who did this research, decades of research, by the way, decades of research, said that many of the health problems can be traced back to poor or slow growth in the womb. Mom eating a lot of soy fat is going to cause some problems. For instance, he's shown that the lighter a baby at birth, the higher its odds of heart disease later life. That means on average a baby weighing less than 5.5 pounds is twice as likely to be killed as a heart attack as an adult than one weighing in at a hefty 9.5. It is thought that when food is scarce in the womb, it's channeled to the fledgling brain, leaving the heart weakened. Small babies are also prone to high cholesterol. It's likely because the liver, which controls how much the unhealthy fat there is in the blood, suffered in the womb to protect the brain. Seeds of diabetes may also be sown in the womb. For instance, the pancreatic cells that make insulin formed before birth. And then the research supports the theory that parents who maintain a healthy lifestyle both at before and after conceiving a baby will give their child the best start in life. This is the same exact. I mean, it's like all three of these articles came out at the same time. And how many people don't know that the growing phases inside the womb and out of the womb for those first 3 to 4 years are not vastly mega important? Oh, wait, let me think. I talk about those people that don't know that in the first hour of every show. Let's take that a step further. You're in the womb, you got some problems, and your brain suffers. You come out, and you like to gamble, or take a lot of drugs, or eat a lot. They're now saying that this is a brain disease. And it is not the addict's fault. They're saying addiction is a chronic brain disease and not just a collection of symptoms such as cravings and mood swings. According to a team of more than 80 experts from the American Society of Addiction Medicine. Let me say that again. From the American Society of Addiction Medicine. Released the new definition following a 4-year consultation process. Study author Dr. Michael Miller, addiction is a lot more than people behaving badly. True whether it was alcohol, drugs, or eating. Addicts generally described by its behavioral symptoms, the highs, the cravings, and the things people do to achieve one and avoid the other. But 2 decades of their science from the American Society of Addiction Medicine says how addiction hijacks different parts of the brain to explain what prompts those behaviors and why they can be so hard to overcome. The society's policy statement is in part an effort to translate these findings of doctors to the general public. They're saying that it's a result of a brain dysfunction. You have family members that go through the frustration of relapses. Now you have a reason to say, I've been to a detox program. How come you're still taking drugs? Well, they're saying the pathology in the brain persists for years after you stop taking the drug. Now get this, genetics play a role. Stuff that happened in the womb play a role. As does age, ladies and gentlemen. Every person, even if a person is not biologically vulnerable to begin with, trying drugs or alcohol can change the brain's reward system. So now that's the exact opposite of what they just said. In other words, your brain wasn't broke, but then when you take alcohol or drugs, your brain gets broke. You do understand that that is the exact opposite of what they're saying. Now, here's the key. Here's where you got the news, then the truth. In the news, all you're going to hear is addiction is a brain disorder, not just a behavioral problem. Here's the truth. The research is now underway to use these new brain findings to develop better treatments. Not just to block an addict's high temporarily, but also to strengthen the underlying brain circuitry to fend off relapse. So all you addicts, it's not your fault. Your brain gets broke from something bad or something your mom did bad. The American Society of Addiction Medicine will come to your aid. Yeah. Come to your aid. How about that, ladies and gentlemen? Eric. Your fault. The brain is broken. It's broken from the corporate empire that created everything. Because that's for what they did. No, they taste of everything. Taste of tea. No, they didn't just create something that was awful. They created a killer. Something that broke your brain. Make you go, I have to have it. I wake up. And I have to have life. And I have to have it when I'm not afraid. In fact, I have to have it when someone has to work down my problem. Which in turn makes me. Which in turn makes me happy. America's out to get you addicted, and then they're out to get you not addicted by getting you addicted. Okay, anyway. Men. Yes, pretty soon we'll all know the whole saga of the Charlie World, but that's totally not important right now. What I'm talking about is men are now smitten with partners much faster than women. That's right. A meaningful glance across a crowded room, a glimpse of a smile, the whiff of perfume. Men are now head over heels in love. I digress to say, even if it's lust. A chap barely even needs to have spoken to the object of his desire before declaring she is the one. I merely have to take a gander at her beauty to know that I am in love with her. Women, however, look at a guy and go, eh, he better do something. She got a car, a job, house. He ain't all that. He ain't got no bag of chips either. That's right, women are now taking almost 6 dates before deciding someone's able to get them smitten. Right? Most men say love at first sight. Most of them are done by the 3rd date. Totally taken in by the woman, smitten completely. Women, however, going, So what would cause this, you think, ladies and gentlemen? Well, Professor Alexander Gordon, a chartered psychologist and member of the British Psychological Society, was intrigued. He says, well, I need a British accent. Men... Wait. bottle, men tended to tick more superficial boxes, such as looks, to help them decide whether they were in love. Women were a little more complicated, likely to weigh up the pros and cons before settling on their choice. Women are better at reading social situations, more likely to ask themselves questions after meeting someone, like, is he going to make me feel secure? Will he make a good father to my children? Will he drop me off in Barbados? Dead, by the way. I'm making light of that lady that's now missing. Don't mean to make light of her death, obviously, but I'm just saying, men are crazy. And then they're saying women are a little better at making the lifetime choice. Are they? If women were the one making the lifetime choice, would we still end up with a divorce rate as high as we do? If women were the best at making the lifetime choice, how come an awful lot of women are very unhappy in their marriage? Men are more likely to say they have loved someone who did not love them back. The average man says they fall in love over 3 times in their life, while the woman says, I fell in love only once. Men are more likely to say, I love you first. But men and women both did agree on one thing. Their first love was the one that took the longest to get over. Well, yeah, you never had to get over it. You didn't know how. If you lost a second love or a second relationship, you go, well, there went another one. It's called wisdom. So does this really tell us anything that we don't already know, ladies and gentlemen? There's very weird door sounds happening around me right now. Oh, we're getting close to the end of the show. Before we go, here's what we're going to really get in deep about. There's an article out, along with all those other exercises, won't kill you, TV will, but if you were born when your mama sucked, then it don't matter because you're going to die anyway. Here's the other one. Self-help books can ruin your life. Now, I am a self-help book author. I have 2 books, working on my 3rd. This is very, very important here. But there's a leading psychologist that says self-help books ruin your life because they promise everything and sell millions of them, but people aren't getting more successful. Wait a minute. Ho, ho, ho. She says, browse the shelves of your local bookshop and you'll find hundreds of books to promise to improve your life in any number of ways. You can read about the secrets to daily joy, lasting fulfillment, career success, emotional healing, how to stop worry or stop ruining your relationships. Self-help book sales are now up 25%. Professor Wilden, okay, says that many self-help authors offer mantras and remedies that were designed to make people feel good, but they don't actually cure what ails them. Ladies and gentlemen, here's a little fact, a little tidbit that we have got to go into. Here's his argument. The fact that there are so many self-help books on the market is likely to be a sign that none of them is particularly effective. Okay. With that argument, the fact that there's a billion vampire pictures is likely to mean that all of that is true. Right? That argument doesn't make any sense. The fact that there are 100 books on getting a baby means none of them work. You're kidding me, right? Well, when you hear about this little article, I need you to understand where they got their information from. They got it from Steve Salerno. What did Steve Salerno do? Did he call somebody up and say motivational books are crap? No. Did he create a YouTube series on self-circumcision? No. Did he draw paintings that say motivational books don't work? No. He wrote a book called Sham: How the Self-Help Movement Made America Helpless. In the book that says self-help books are worthless, he says that if you buy into the overblown claims such books make, can lead you to blaming yourself for failure when you don't achieve the outcome you hope for, and you avoid treatments that actually work. So, what are you saying? What he's saying is that reading a self-help book is like buying a lottery ticket. For a small investment, we get hope in return, the dream that all of our problems will soon be solved without any real expectation that they will be. Am I the only one that finds humor in this? That this guy wrote a book saying self-help books are not going to help? And it's like buying a lottery ticket? You're reading the book knowing it's not going to help you? I do not agree with him whatsoever. I know what self-help books have done for me. If they change your attitude and they change your way of life, if you actually make the steps to be different, then the book did its job. If you simply read, let me show you the fact. Most people won't read the book that they purchase. They purchase it to feel good that it's sitting on their shelf. Did he go into that fact? Remember, way back at the beginning of this show, over years ago, I went through that. Most people don't even read another book past high school. Then when they do read a book, they read nonfiction. I mean, they read fiction. The other ones that buy most of the motivational books actually read either the table of contents or one or two chapters and then put the book up. With that being the case, does that mean the book writer is the problem or the book reader is the problem? Scientific research has shown that some forms of positive thinking are indeed beneficial because they have revealed three key ingredients to human happiness: meaning, hope, and purpose. Now, if the books are telling you this and you're not reading them, what's happening? Why would you go after the author? Why would you go after the author of books by writing a book? I would think you'd have made a movie, drawn a painting, called up the news agency, said, give me an hour. There are techniques that have been shown scientifically to make people happier. There's the Pennebaker exercise. Is there something in your life you're particularly worried or upset about right now? If it's been on your mind for several weeks, try this technique. Commit to writing about that problem for at least 15 minutes a day for 3 or 4 consecutive days. At the end of the day, without interruption, writing your thoughts and feelings down about a specific issue really can help you analyze and change your feelings and approach to it. I can tell you right now that my self-help book, Natural Success Principles, available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and BooksAMillion.com, all of those, when you get done with the book, it actually can, you can order, not order, you get a free workbook. Now, my book is, my first book was a bestseller. This book has been, thousands of people have bought this book. Thousands of people have been given this book. I give away books all the time. How many people ask for their free workbook? 3. How many of those 3, at the end of that workbook, they were told to send me their answers and they would get something else free? None. So if the self-help book tells you to do an exercise, such as the Pennebaker exercise, or to step back and look inside yourself and actually commit it to writing it down, and you do not do that, how is it the author's fault? How does this Steve Salerno have the audacity to even say, read my book, which talks about how other books are crap, when he's not even grasping the fact that people don't read the other books? A person sitting at home in a beanbag eating Cheetos is not going to go want to read How to Change Your Life in 50 Days. They're going to want to buy it. They're going to want to have that lottery mentality. They're going to want it on their shelf, and then they're going to want to belittle it because they're going to go, look, it's been 50 days, and ain't nothing happened. Well, did you do everything it said, Bob? No, I didn't even get around to reading it. But still, I bought it. What? I love it. I love it. Oh, there's also another book, The Surprising New Science of Psychological Change by, I'm not telling you who. It's another book to tell you that self-help books could help you if you do these certain things. But if you don't, they won't. What is wrong with these people? Yeah, isn't that a self-help book in itself? Exactly. Isn't Steve Salerno's sham, How the Self-Help Movement Made America Helpless, a self-help book? Because isn't he telling you, don't read that book, read this book, and I give you actual real, because what he says, when you buy into overblown claims the books make, you blame yourself for failure and you avoid treatments that actually work, then he tells you the treatments that he says actually works inside the book. Is that not self-help? It is if you do it. That's the reason they're called self-help books. Because you not have a coach standing behind you going, do it. Do it now. One of the reasons I brought up the elite athletes, ladies and gentlemen, because if you go buy a self-help book and you don't have the self-motivation, self-help means no help. There's nothing. A book can't beat you upside the head by itself, but a coach with the book can. This is why I do coaching. A lot of people ask for the coaching after reading the book and realize, you know, I have been unable to take these steps that you say I should do in the book for all of my former life. And now I read the book and I know what I got to do, but I just don't think I can make that happen. So I'd like a coach. I'd like someone to hit me when I got down. Well, Steve, Mr. Sham, self-help book writer, I can guarantee you that if people read your book, where you, in fact, sit there and go, all those other books are crap, here's what you need to do, and they don't do it, does that mean your book is a sham? By your own definition, would be yes. Because if they read my book and do nothing, I'm a sham. They read your book and do nothing, are you a genius? No, you're a sham. No, neither one of us are bad in any right. You just seem to attack people versus, you know, all of us getting in one boat and fixing the problem. You're still coming up with ways for people to be better and help themselves. But I promise you that if they read your book and they don't do it, it's not your fault. Sorry I had to bring that up, because that was just totally, totally an asinine way to think. And that book, his ideas probably... He probably had a good idea, and he's trying to help people, but he's going about it in a very wrong way. All right, our political segment. I hate to wait all the way to the end for this, because it's just going to end on a bad note. I have got to really bust on to the Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack. That's right. Brilliant man, Secretary of Agriculture, because did you know who puts out the Secretary, the SNAP program? You know what the SNAP program is, ladies and gentlemen? That's the food stamp program. Because we have the largest amount of human beings on the food stamp program than we've ever had in the history of the United States of America. And the problem I believe that you need to grasp of that fact, not just the fact that there are more people on food stamps, because yes, I can sit here and see the logic in there's more people in America, right? I could see that logic. But it should scare the living out of you when the Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, has this idea in his head. Quote, well, obviously, it's putting people to work, which is why we're going to have some interesting things in the course of the forum this morning. He was talking about whatever he's going to talk about. And then later this week, we're going to have a press conference with Secretary Mavis, Secretary Chu. Now, something that's never happened in this country and something we think is exciting in terms of job growth. Okay? So he's saying, I'm about to say some stuff later in the week that's going to make people get jobs. But here's his continuation of his quote. I should point out, when you talk about the SNAP program or the food stamp program, you have to recognize that it is an economic stimulus. Every dollar of food stamp benefits generates $1.84 in the economy in terms of economic activity. If people are able to buy a little more at the grocery store, someone has to stock it, package it, shelve it, process it, ship it. All of those are jobs. It is the most direct stimulus you can get in the economy during these tough times. Do you hear what I just told you this man's mind thinks? I am almost out of time, but I want you to grasp. This man just said that every time he puts someone on food stamps, he's helping the economy. Would that not say that we should all just be on food stamps? The economy would be a booming, ballooning wonderland. I don't have time to go into this any deeper. I'm almost out of time. I'm so sorry. Thank you for listening to the Jack Hatfield Show. Thank you, Adele Amani, for your magnificent minute and giving us some class. Go have your beverage. Shave some minutes off your life, but enjoy it. Twitter. Thank you.